Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Yesterday on Lake Effect, we heard how Wisconsin's Oneida Indian Nation is turning to indigenous agricultural practices in order to put food on the table during the coronavirus pandemic and recession. But how did that resilient, self-reliant attitude become such a hallmark of American Indian life? Lake Effect's Julian Heiner recently caught up with an indigenous historian, Heather Briegel, to discuss some of the pretext, viral and otherwise, for how America's First Nations live today.
Heather Briegel, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Yeah, not a problem.
So I think a lot of people think of 1492 as the seminal moment when Christopher Columbus brought disease to the Americas. A lot of people kind of invoke that as a very traumatic time because a lot of indigenous people were killed at that moment. But that's not the whole picture. What are some of the things that people miss in that 500-year span?
Yeah, so I guess while we're in school, you know, we do hear 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. It's funny that that's the first thing that you start with. I have a t-shirt from a Native-owned company that says Native history started before 1492. So I always like to let people know, you know, we were here before that. But obviously 1492 is the pivotal point where, you know, we are having contact with colonists or explorers who are coming in to the Americas. And with them, they did bring disease, unfortunately. And because we were so isolated, you know, on Turtle Island for such a long, long time, centuries.
Turtle Island being North America.
The Americas. Yep, the Americas, North America. We didn't have those immunities built up to the diseases that were brought over. And one of the big diseases that we hear about is smallpox. And smallpox took a major toll on the Native communities, you know, when it was first introduced from European settlers, colonists, colonizers, what have you. And it struck New England really hard in 1633. And much of the New England Indians were virtually wiped out. They went from a population that was around 16,000, if you combined the Mohegan and the Pequot populations, down to 3,000. So it was incredible the way that the disease spread through the Native nations. And, you know, so it started in New England and it would just slowly work its way across the United States, down to the Southeast tribes, the Great Lakes tribes, out to the West. And, you know, you hear those jokes about Native people given blankets, you know, with, you know, smallpox in them, you know, on them. Those necessarily weren't jokes. I mean, that actually happened. So, you know, facing pandemics in the past is not anything that's new to Native America. It's more detrimental to us and our Native nations, but it is something we've had to deal with in the past, whether it was that smallpox, you know, first being brought over, or even, you know, the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918.
Yeah, you noted something, and I was hoping you could expand on it a little bit, about predisposition. So there's a lot of conversation right now about immunity, right? You mentioned smallpox. There was a vaccine developed for that. But the idea of minority communities, American Indian communities, Black and Latinx communities being predisposed to heart disease, some people say that's connected to poverty. How has the coronavirus kind of discourse played in American indigenous communities with regards to those health effects that have existed for a long time?
So we do know that with coronavirus, those that are more susceptible to it are in a certain age bracket. So whether that is, I believe it's 60 and older. And then we also know that the other groups of people that are more susceptible to coronavirus, particularly in the underlying health conditions of heart disease and diabetes, those two things run rampant in Indian country. Diabetes rates amongst Native people versus non-Native people is much higher. Heart disease rates amongst Native people versus non-Native people is also much higher. And those can be attributed to, I know you'd mentioned some people say that it's attributed to poverty. It can be attributed to that. But one thing that we have to take a look at is how did these poverty conditions be created? And you can trace that back to when we were forced onto reservations during Indian removal in the 1830s.
I was hoping you could expand on some of that. I think people know about Indian casinos. Maybe people drive to reservations to fill up their gas tanks. There's a lot of kind of economic life on reservations that has slowed down, and through some of that historical legislation has proven to be a bit of a double-edged sword in terms of the economic life that Indigenous people are able to have.
It truly has. I know across the country, and even here in Wisconsin, your tribal casinos are not operating right now. I work for the Stockbridge Muncie community, and our tribal casino has been shut down since March 21st. It is still shut down and will remain so through at least May 26th, when the original Safer at Home order was to expire. If you have a successful tribal casino, that is where most of your tribal revenue comes from. And those being shut down has a huge impact on the financial stability of a tribe, no matter how large or small you are. The Stockbridge Muncie community is a smaller community, say compared to the Oneida community of Wisconsin, which is a larger community. But we're going to still have, both tribes are still going to have economic impacts that are going to take years to recover from. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult to see what happens, you know, the rest of this year, 2020, going into 2021 and 2022, to see how we, you know, recover. But if history has taught us anything, as I said earlier, as a people, we are resilient and we will come back from this.
It's very interesting how that seems to reveal some of the difficult aspects of maintaining tribal sovereignty. I mean, on one hand, you want to have self-determination as a sovereign nation, but on the other hand, it's difficult to live out like a economically self-sustaining life without needing to depend on things like a casino. So how does that trade-off play out historically? The urge to, for example, leave a nation, assimilate into culture because it provides for economic opportunities, versus staying with your nation, sovereign as it is, but in a difficult situation, in a moment of crisis like this?
Right. No, that's a great question. I myself personally was not born on a reservation. I wasn't raised on a reservation. I am an enrolled citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin and a first-line descendant Stockbridge Muncie, but I was not raised on either reservation. I was raised in the city. I played on concrete jungles and things like that. And the only time we ever visited the reservation when I was growing up was during powwow or to visit family or what have you. Even though I wasn't born on a reservation, I knew with the gifts that I received in the outside world and my education, I needed to come back and help, you know, further along the causes of my people. And I think that's what a lot of people think about when they leave, you know, the reservation to come back. Yes, we are sovereign and we carry that with us no matter where we are, but we do know, and the people who live on the reservation do understand, that there are economic hardships that can't always be fixed right there.
That's very interesting. It certainly reflects a diaspora experience, even though it is still very local. So that's very interesting to hear. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and I'm speaking with Heather Briegel. She's an Indigenous historian and writer who runs cultural affairs for the Stockbridge Munsee Band of the Mohican Indians in Wisconsin. I wanted to pull a little bit more of that thread of sovereignty. I saw that originally two tribes in Wisconsin have agreed to follow Governor Evers Seyfert home orders. That's the Oneida, which you mentioned earlier. The Menominee Nation did as well. But in other places like South Dakota, there has been a little bit of a standoff between the Sioux tribes and the state over access in and out of their reservations. So I'm wondering, like, when it comes to sovereignty and protecting health, how does that depend on where you are in the country?
I think if you are in an area of the country where, with your state leadership, you have a good relationship with them, they understand where you are, you understand where they are, your state leadership understands what sovereignty is, your state leadership understands that they are not dealing with an ethnic group, they are dealing with a nation within a nation, I think then your relationship is good. And I think what you are able to accomplish is good.
South Dakota has had plenty of flashpoints, hasn't it, with between Indigenous communities and the government?
Yes, it has been. I think here in Wisconsin, it's safe to say that the relationship between the tribal nations and the state leadership, particularly the governor, is good. I think there is some issue within like our state, like I think in Wisconsin they're called assembly people. So like your state senators or your state representatives, I think depending on where you are, it could be a little different. I think in areas of the country where there have been contentious issues historically, I think that's where it gets a little bit difficult. And I think that's where we're running into issues in South Dakota. The South Dakota governor is a Republican, and this is not her first run-in with the tribes in South Dakota where she's had issues. And I think there's a huge lack of understanding of Indian law and Indian history, where I feel like that gets lost in translation, where people just think, oh, well, you can do this or you can do that. Well, no, you can't, because we have laws in place or we have treaties in place that say the state, you're overstepping your boundaries. I think that lack of education in Indian history and Indian law plays a huge effect on how the relationship is between tribal nations, state government, and federal government.
Well, I think some people might be surprised, especially people who might not be following tribal issues as closely as someone who's enrolled in a nation such as yourself, that the colonization of certain nations and the disregard for certain treaties persists well into the 21st century in some cases.
Yes, it does. I mean, we just have to look at what happened at Standing Rock with the Dakota Access Pipeline. We just have to look at what happens with the Keystone XL Pipeline. We have to just look and see what happens, or you just need to look and see what happens with an epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and the lack of federal and state help in regards to that epidemic. I mean, look what's happening now with this COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, there is, I mean, and even as this is going on, there's a case in the Supreme Court of the United States right now that is arguing whether or not reservations actually exist in the state of Oklahoma. So we are constantly having to fight for our own sovereignty. We have to fight to make people aware of our history, and we have to fight to make people honor our treaties. So it's a constant battle.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That Oklahoma case is also very interesting. I encourage people to Google it.
Yes.
If it goes through, as some of the people hope that it does, much of Tulsa will be under tribal authority, which would be very interesting for the people of Tulsa, very different than what it
It
is
would
now.
basically be the eastern half of Oklahoma. It's huge.
Well, it's very interesting to see some of that playing out. Now we've talked a little bit about the negative, about the kind of, benign neglect that happens out of convenience sometimes with indigenous groups and tribal nations. Tell me a bit about some of the positive. What is some of the solidarity that happens between Indian groups and also solidarity between Native American tribes and other nations, ethnic groups that have faced colonization and hunger?
Yeah, so in spite of all of this that is happening, there are definitely some bright spots and positive things happening. I've seen communities come together, Native communities come together to help each other, to help other Native communities. I was actually just on social media, which I'm on a lot during this pandemic, but just, I saw in the weeks since it started, there were people in different Native groups in the state of Wisconsin who were getting together and making masks to send to the Navajo Nation, where we know they are hit really hard right now with over 3,000 cases of COVID-19. We see in the Stockbridge Munsee community, our elders who are at home right now, people in the community have gotten together to put together goodie bags, for them, little snacks and, essential items such as, cleaning supplies and things like that. So that has happened. You've had some non-Native groups who have come in to help the Native nations. And one of the groups that has actually stepped in is the Irish. And the people in Ireland, if you're not familiar with your Irish history, suffered a really horrible famine back in the 1800s, the potato famine. And of course, it hit that country extremely hard, and it was devastating to them. Well, nobody wants to see anybody ever go hungry. So we had a couple groups of Native people here in the United States actually send money over to the Irish to help them during this time. And one of the groups was the Choctaw Nation, who are now, they were displaced from their home in southeast United States to Indian Territory, which was Oklahoma in 1831. And it was a few years after they were displaced, they sent money to the Irish, and they didn't have a lot to send. And but they were like, it's our job to help them. And with the passing of the CARES Act this year during the COVID-19 pandemic, there was money that was set aside for Native nations, but it's been very slow to get out to the Native nations here in the United States. Well, the Irish got wind of this, and they started, of all things, a GoFundMe page. And they've
No
raised
kidding.
a GoFundMe page, of all things, and they've raised, last I checked, was $1.9 million, and this was to pay back a kindness that was done to them during their time of need. And so this money will be distributed to the Navajo and Hopi nations, who are being hit extremely hard by the pandemic right now. And it's if you read some of the comments on the GoFundMe page that people have posted, or even just reading news articles about it, when asked why are they doing this, and the Irish, who were also a colonized people, which a lot of times I think people forget, but the English did colonize them as well, and their response to helping out to the Native nations in the United States is they're our brethren. They helped us in our time of need. It's the least we can do to help them. So to pay a 170-year-old kindness of $170, this GoFundMe page has raised almost $1.9 million right
That's really incredible, and
now.
I mean it's inspiring, but it also shows where the gaps are in terms of how people are served. So that's very, very interesting. Thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect, Heather.
Oh, thank you.
That was Heather Briegel, an Indigenous historian and writer who runs cultural affairs for the Stockbridge Munsee Band of the Mohican Indians in Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. As mentioned during the interview, shuttered casinos are challenging the economic independence of many tribes. Since this interview was recorded, the Oneida Nation announced they will be reopening their casino on May 26th. Social distancing, protective equipment, and other precautions will be enforced.